This week on the Finding Impact podcast, we're digging into the business of Coco Networks in Kenya. And they make and sell bioethanol stove and distribute the fuel through neighborhood level kiosks with their co-founder, Sagon Saxena.
FindingImpact.com. FindingImpact.com. Helping you scale your social business.
Hey everyone, my name is Andy Narica. I'm the founder of this show, Finding Impact, which is really set up to share lessons learned, to get people on to talk about their experiences, their challenges, and basically so you don't have to reinvent the wheel. And today we've got the last episode in our three-part series that we've been doing with support from the Lemelson Foundation. And we have six episodes now that dig into the challenges and workarounds of invention-based entrepreneurs that have faced getting their products to market in very challenging markets. And really excited for this six-part series. So go and check them out. And while you're there, sign up to the newsletter, because I bring out this newsletter fortnightly. I provide bookmarks into the interviews, how you can go in and find the information you want from those interviews. And it comes out every 2 weeks, and it's got some really useful links in there as well on the social enterprise scene. So head on over to findingimpact.com and sign up on the homepage. And we're also bringing out a highly actionable playbook, which we're distilling all of the advice and knowledge we've got from these six interviews on hardware entrepreneurs. And you've got to be on the list to receive that. So make sure you sign up and it will be in your inbox very soon. Okay, so let's get straight into the interview. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Sagon Saxena. Hey everyone, I've got Sagon Saxena here, and we're continuing on the theme of hardware entrepreneurs and the challenges they face in emerging markets bringing products to market. And we've got some really important lessons to share. I'm excited about this interview. Sagon is co-founder and chief innovation officer at Coco Networks, a company operating in Kenya and India that builds and deploys a dense network of kiosks inside local corner stores and so on that distributes bioethanol for the modern cookers they sell. Without further ado, welcome, Sagon.
Yeah, thanks, Andy. Thanks very much for having me on your show.
Pleasure. Well, thanks for coming on and sharing about this important topic. But let's start with the physical products. Let's start with the cooker. With the cooker and with the kiosks where they go to fetch the fuel, can you describe how your customer uses your product on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, sure. So our launch offering is this affordable modern two-burner cooking solution. We use liquid ethanol. So this is bioethanol as the fuel. Bioethanol is available abundantly in this part of the world. It's a sustainable, renewable energy source. And so customers, when they buy our stove, also receive a two-liter fuel canister. And so what they do is they take this two-liter fuel canister to these machines that Coco has developed that are very much like ATM machines that contain the bioethanol fuel. And these ATM machines, we call them Coco Points, are deployed inside small shops in the target neighborhood. So within a few hundred meters of every household in our target market segment, that's the low to mid-income segment, across Nairobi, households will have a Coco Point available to them. And so they take this reusable container to the Coco Point, attach it securely to the Coco Point. The Coco Point is cloud connected, and it maintains a balance, a customer balance that our consumers are able to top up using mobile money. And so once they've inserted the canister, they can purchase the amount of fuel they wish to get. It can be the full canister, which is about a week's worth of fuel. Or, you know, if they have less cash that day, they can purchase as little as 30 cents worth of cooking fuel. So almost a daily amount of cooking fuel. And then they take that back home, insert it in their stove. The stove, safely refills with the fuel, and then they can light it instantly, control the heat output, and turn the stove off very quickly and safely. That's very different than the traditional fuels that this market segment is using. Most people are using charcoal or kerosene for cooking on a daily basis. So modern fuels like LPG and electricity are just really expensive for this segment. So what we're basically doing is bringing to market a solution that makes it much faster, easier, and cheaper for people to cook with a modern cooking solution than they can today. That's really the core of our offering here in Nairobi.
Brilliant. So you're just in Nairobi? Can you give us a sense of the scale you're at? I mean, I see you're in Kenya and India, but what's the sort of scale you're at the moment?
Sure. So we are an international company. Nairobi is the first market where we are deploying our solution, the Coco Fuel solution. So our India teams are basically supporting us on the engineering and the manufacturing, and we'll talk more about that later, I'm sure. But the first commercial market we're targeting, the first region we're targeting is East Africa, and the first country within that is Kenya. Our network is now up and running in Nairobi, so we have 700 Coco Point dispensers now throughout the city, and over the next year we'll be rolling out in at least a dozen other markets in Kenya, and we're also beginning partnership discussions in other markets across East Africa. Our target markets are, of course, fast-growing cities where populations have purchasing power but continue to rely on charcoal and kerosene as a fuel. In the longer term, our intention is really to be in at least 40 or 50 major metropolitan areas across sub-Saharan Africa, and indeed other parts of the world as well, where we see the potential for this kind of a solution to work.
Brilliant. So 700 dispensers. What does that equate to in terms of the number of cookers that are out there using those 700 dispensers?
Sure. So our target is to get around 200 to 250 households for each of these dispenser locations. So if you do the math, that's a target market of around 150,000 households in Nairobi. We think that's available to us. Indeed, we believe we can go significantly beyond that. Greater Nairobi has about 1 million households or so. And so we think a market share in the 15 to 20%, given current market dynamics, is very achievable for us. And indeed, with the right, with a level playing field from a taxation perspective, we believe the government of Kenya could make the solution, could drive the adoption of the solution much more widely across cities like Nairobi and others. So we launched this solution in mid-2019, so just a couple of months ago. We're rapidly now distributing stoves to each of these locations. And really at this point, the supply of the stoves and canisters from our own manufacturing plant is the fundamental constraint. But our goal is to move at least a couple of stoves per location per day, and to scale that up until the point that we reach saturation in the network. Over time, of course, we will add more Coco Point locations in the areas where we see the greatest traction and the density of our target customer base.
Okay. Well, this is all fascinating. I mean, all about the business model and the saturation. This is huge, but I'm going to take it towards the physical hardware discussion for this purpose of this interview, but maybe another time we can dig into all of that. So you mentioned the 2-liter fuel canister that is basically the interface between the kiosk or the Coco Point and the household cook stove. I'd love you could just tell us a little bit about how, because you're moving highly flammable liquid around the city, right? So, well, you not, but this is what goes into your product. So can you give us a sense of the infrastructure that's needed to keep these cookers fueled, essentially, and the kiosks?
Yeah, sure. So a key part of our business strategy was to bring in the existing fuel distribution companies, and I'm thinking of the big oil marketing companies, the likes of Shell and so forth, to bring them in as a partner in the business model, right? These fuel companies have huge amounts of infrastructure already in place for distributing liquid fuels at scale. And so what we've done is basically create a business model that involves them as the fuel supplier. So each of these Coco Points mentioned is actually stocked by our fuel company partner. Here in Kenya, that partner is Vivo Energy, which is the Shell licensee, the operator of the Shell brand here in this part of the world. And so Vivo Energy is responsible for basically sourcing the bioethanol and using their infrastructure to bring that in to the city. And in fact, Vivo has converted 9 petrol stations out of their existing network of around 60 petrol stations in Greater Nairobi to receive bulk amounts of ethanol fuel, store them safely in their underground storage tanks, and then use small tanker trucks that are technology to safely get that fuel to each of the cocoa points. The way it works is that each cocoa point has lots of sensors on board, and as the fuel level drops below the threshold, our systems automatically notify Vivo Energy's dispatch team, and they're then able to direct their trucks using some of our technology to the right locations where they can open the cocoa point access box, which is mounted on the outside of each shop location, attach the hoses, and safely refill the unit. And as soon as that refilling is complete, our sensors are able to track exactly how much fuel was delivered, and we can then settle the payments between the shopkeeper who owns the fuel and the supplier of the fuel, Vivo Energy. And so that technology that kind of drops in and really fits onto the existing fuel distribution infrastructure is really, really important to make sure that we can create a network for moving fuel very safely and efficiently without making huge, massive new investments in infrastructure. In fact, a recent study done by Dahlberg, the consultancy, found that the cost of introducing bioethanol as a cooking fuel in a city such as Nairobi is about, you know, 1/20th the cost of similarly making LPG available to the households across the city. So it's a really efficient model of using the existing fuel distribution infrastructure that we've targeted for ensuring that each of these cocoa point dispensers always has high quality fuel available, and that the whole process is safe and meets the standards that a major energy company would operate at.
Mm. Well, we'll talk a little bit about the standards and stuff like that, because I think that's, you know, obviously a really important hurdle to get around when you're introducing a fuel product in the market in Kenya. But so let's talk about these products now. Now, you've got your cooker and your ethanol, the cocoa point. Let's talk about the cooker first, because and you mentioned earlier that you manufacture it in India. Can you talk about the decision to manufacture in India versus locally in Kenya? Because I'm sure many entrepreneurs, hardware entrepreneurs, face this challenge or this question. And, you know, there's local forces to say manufacture, make local, you know, whereas sometimes it's just really difficult. So thinking of what you've learned, why have you decided to manufacture in India? And you know, would you still make that same decision as things changed? Or, you know, what advice to others who are thinking about that question?
Well, it's a really important question. And it took us a lot of analysis over the course of really a period of maybe 2 years or more. As we started the cooker design activities in Nairobi, you know, there are existing ethanol camping stoves available in the market, but it was clear we needed a product that was better designed to meet the needs of the target market in terms of price, in terms of performance, everything else. So we began the design process. And during that phase, we were very open about where we would manufacture this. And we were very keen indeed to do it here in Kenya for a whole range of reasons. And the government of Kenya has been a great partner, and they were quite keen to see that we were able to do this here. As we went through the design process, what became clear is that the costs of mass manufacturing this product here in Kenya would be higher than they would be in other parts of the world. So that was one consideration. You know, we want to have a higher cost that needs to be passed through to end customers. And then the factors driving the costs were many. It was not just the cost of materials or the cost of the equipment for a factory or the cost for the labor. There were many, many factors that required careful analysis. But that was one. That was just one of the factors. The second factor was that as the market gets saturated, the demand for cookers will decrease. Right. So this is not a manufacturing capacity or manufacturing operation that will continue on a long-term basis. It's more of a one-time requirement. And there's a fundamental question of what happens to that investment in a manufacturing plant once demand really tails off. That was a second consideration. Third one for cocoa, again, we're an international company. We're targeting markets across sub-Saharan Africa. And definitely Nairobi is not necessarily the place in the world to build large-scale manufacturing capacity to serve all these different ports across sub-Saharan Africa. And so we started thinking about things from the perspective of logistics, and that also made clear that another part of the world would be advantageous. And so those were the factors that made us look outside of Kenya. And our design partners for the stoves were based in India, and so we were quickly able to assess the feasibility of setting up a manufacturing unit there. And we found advantageous infrastructure and other facilities available there that really meet the requirements of this type of product. And so our factory today, based in Gujarat, in the west of India, is in a place where we have access to fantastic physical infrastructure, great human resources, and we're really in a cluster that is well-suited for manufacturing. So in terms of the equipment supplies, in terms of raw material supplies, and support of the government, it's turned out to be a great location. And from there, we can ship efficiently pretty much anywhere in the world. And so that's how this decision process worked out for us. For friends and colleagues and other people that we see trying to make the same decision, my advice is that there are no shortcuts. I think you have to go through the analysis. It's very dependent on your business models and your aspirations longer term. And cost is just one factor to consider, but there are indeed a lot of other things that need to be weighed in into the decision.
Brilliant. That's really good. So those three pieces were the main factors in your decision process. I mean, if you could just go back to the first one, you mentioned a few factors which impact on the cost. I don't know if you could dig into those a bit more, like materials, labor. You talked about is there anything else that you think is lacking, I think, in East Africa that really pushes people to go into India or other markets for manufacturing? And are things changing? Are you seeing anything changing for East Africa?
Sure. No, things are changing rapidly. I think that I'm sure many of your listeners have a good sense of how dynamic this market is and how forward-thinking many of the governments here are about trying to really promote industrialization and to drive investment into these markets. What are the cost factors beyond the ones I mentioned? I think that, they're all things related to the absence of an installed base of manufacturing that's operating at really high scale, right? So for example, when we're looking for, our manufacturing processes involve a lot of sheet metal production processes, plastic injection molding processes, a number of other technologies for joining, things like laser welding of plastics, etc. So some of these processes that are slightly high-tech and need to be for us to achieve our target economics and throughput rates, those kind of processes you won't find in operation here today, right? So you won't have the skilled operators, you won't have the ecosystem of equipment suppliers and equipment maintenance providers, those kinds of things. And so the situation you end up in is that if you want to bring that kind of process here, you need to really invest significantly in things like spare parts, in additional training or the ability to bring in people to provide service on very short notice, all those kinds of things. And as one manufacturer trying to do that, it becomes really difficult. If you contrast that with the environment we have in India, where each of the processes that we're running, within 20 kilometers of us, there are hundreds of other factories that have the same equipment, that are using the same processes. And so the vendors are really able to provide a level of service that you just can't get here. And so all of that adds to, it ends up affecting your production costs. It also ends up affecting your ability to scale. It ends up ensuring that you're maximizing the throughput through your manufacturing plant. So those are the type of, additional considerations that really matter. Then, in addition to that, there are other infrastructure costs. Electricity is definitely one of them. We are in a region in India now where the power supply is quite reliable, and it's quite affordable as well, and it's indeed quite green, which is important for us. And so that was something that means that we actually don't have to make huge investments in backup power generation, etc., or the additional costs of having to clean the power or to maintain equipment that's affecting power conditions, those kinds of things. And then even additional things like just the contract labor supply that's required. Our manufacturing operation is quite manual. It's manually intensive for a whole range of reasons. But that does mean that we need a supply of contract workers who have experience working in advanced manufacturing operations. We're surrounded by large automotive plants. And so many of the contract workers that are available to us come in with a good understanding of what a world-class manufacturing looks like and how they can contribute into that is another huge factor for us that gives us advantage. So we have great quality workers who have good experience that are available to us on a flexible basis, which is important, and at a price point that's really competitive globally. And so, and the ecosystem has things like, you know, fantastic services available to the contract workers, transportation, accommodation, all those kinds of things. As a company, as an entrepreneur, you know, we don't have to make all the investments ourselves in providing that. And that just allows us to move faster and to operate more. So these are some of the other considerations as well, related to where to set up manufacturing.
Yeah, no, brilliant and very thorough. Thank you. Let's talk about on the downsides. I mean, there must be a few, right? Because you have to, it's a trade-off. So some of the maybe import uncertainty or things like that. Any other considerations that cause you numerous headaches?
Sure. There's definitely a lot of factors. I mean, we're far away from where we produce to where we sell, which means that there is a long logistics chain, which is tricky in these parts of the world, right? So there's a lot of dependency on logistics working efficiently and according to schedules, because of course we're tying up working capital from when we buy the raw materials to when we sell a finished product. So we want that to move as quickly as possible. We want to make sure products are not damaged or that they don't go missing during the chain. So those are challenges. And then, of course, there are, you know, all the costs associated with logistics and with moving products, you know, into this market. So we have import duties, VAT, and other fees that are levied for importation into the country. Sometimes those things are uncertain, which just adds risk and complexity to the operation. You know, for example, just to give you an example, and this is, I think, an example many of your listeners will be familiar with, when you're creating a new product and the category is not defined, then how is your product to be taxed? What is the duty rate that's applicable? Many of these markets have incentives for clean energy products, but how do you make the case that your product should qualify as a clean energy product? Those are the kinds of things that we've had to spend quite some time working through, you know, getting standards passed so that our products are recognized as fitting a category that the government is keen to see, you know, the technology come into the country. All these kinds of things, additional work that needs to be done to try to manage the risks of logistics and importation into the markets. And so that's definitely a cost. That's definitely an important consideration in making this decision.
Yeah, no, it's really helpful. I think, you know, let's jump on that now, the regulations and compliance, because what you're doing here is you're bringing in a product from outside. And I guess, you know, authorities in Kenya, like the Kenya Bureau Standards, will jump on that, right? And they'll want to make sure that your product is compliant and it's able to, you know, compete in the environment. Can you talk about achieving that compliance, about, you know, maybe just the top level tips that you can give to other entrepreneurs who are considering bringing in a product and having to get that compliance? Because obviously that's something that, you know, that investors will want tied up before they put money behind you.
Sure, absolutely. And yeah, a lot of interesting things in that question. I'll leave the investor part maybe for later.
Yeah,
but definitely, you know, the first of all, I think one has to accept that it's a long process and it's an uncertain process, right? In terms of being able to get the support that's required to introduce a new category of solutions. That's the first point. Now, in our case, you know, clean cooking is definitely a priority. The government of Kenya has mentioned this is one of the reasons we chose this market as one of the first markets for us. Kenya also, you know, justifiably has a reputation for innovation, right? This is a country of innovators, of entrepreneurs, and that's reflected in the government. You know, we can go and talk about our interest in creating a new product category, indeed a new industry, an ethanol cooking industry, and the government is supportive. They encourage that. They want to see that innovation happen. And furthermore, you know, other countries in the region respect how the government of Kenya looks at new technology. So the Kenyan Bureau of Standards, KEBS, who you referred to, is really influential in the region as a regulatory body that has a very rigorous process for supporting innovation and making new products available. And so that was an important consideration for us at the outset. But notwithstanding all of that, it's a long process. And so early on, we introduced ourselves and what we sought to do. We really have had a very open relationship as we went through an iterative product design process. We involved people from the Bureau of Standards and other related agencies, you know, some of the ministries, etc. We also found that it was very useful to have a partnership with some of the leading universities in the region, many of whom are also respected by the Bureau of Standards and by the government, and can provide a really independent voice with regards to the technologies that we're developing and their applicability, and can really ensure that the government puts in place standards that are technically sound, but that are also fair and reasonable, and ones that don't stifle the development of a new industry or indeed a company. And so that's been a good partnership for us, to involve universities, other research organizations, and then to engage directly with the government as a partner, because we share the same vision. I mean, everyone wants to see a new technology become available that can improve people's lives, make cooking cleaner and more affordable. And so it's really a matter of just figuring out the details of what does that mean. You know, from our side, it's not just about having our products approved for sale in the market. You know, we're also very keen to make sure that standards are in place that prevent really inferior products that where, for example, durability considerations haven't been adequately thought of. We're really keen to ensure that standards are in place to prevent those types of products from coming into the market once this category of ethanol cooking is well established. And so from our perspective, it's sort of not only just compliance, but also sort of protecting consumers and making sure that the foundations for an industry are set properly. And it's from our investors, you know, we justify the time and effort involved, partly, you know, due to, of course, it's a license to do business, but also it's important because we'll be able to take this other markets. We'll be able to take the support of the Kenyan government and the Bureau of Standards and use that to accelerate the process for registering these products. And that's indeed what's happening now.
That's really good. So that's important, that last bit. So another reason for choosing Kenya is the, you know, really good reputation of the standards authority here, and you can take that credit as that's added credibility to entering new markets. You mentioned the partnership with universities. Again, that's adding credibility to the conversation. Any other key partnerships that have added to that when you're going to approach the Bureau of Standards that you know, have helped you in that conversation?
Sure. A couple of others. I think you know, there is a growing ecosystem here of innovation. So organizations like Gearbox, you may have heard of, that they absolutely, which, you know, tied to universities and again a good reputation for promoting innovation in a way that it's really responsible and that's forward. That's been helpful for us. And then some of our commercial partners. So definitely Vivo Energy in Kenya is one of the, you know, fuel distributors in this region, and the licensee of the Shell brand is a great partner. They have a lot of technical credibility, you know, world-class facilities in terms of safety and environmental management. And so you can imagine having gone through due diligence from their side adds to the credibility we have when we talk about launching a new technology here in Kenya. And so that partnership was also really important.
Brilliant. So moving on, mobilizing capital is obviously really difficult as a startup, full stop, but maybe even more so as a hardware entrepreneur when you're creating products. Now, can you just give us some sense of how that of that difficulty and something that anything that you've learned that will guide other entrepreneurs who are, you know, trying to develop, get an invention out there, you know, what stage should they be looking for capital? You know, what do they need to have, what stage they're at? Because I think it's quite unique for hardware entrepreneurs.
Yes, it's definitely a challenge. And I think it's hard to give advice because there's so much difference, so many differences across the different types of products and categories. In our case, you know, we had additional challenges in the sense that it's hard for us to show that, you know, the ethanol stove is not the only hardware component we need. We need to have fuel distribution infrastructure and other hardware components as well, a whole network in operation to be able to convince investors that this will work. And so how did we go about it? The process was, first of all, to articulate a vision, right? So we said, this is the vision of a whole ecosystem of hardware and software working together. Then we showed, you know, we really tried to demonstrate the demand, right? So we created some initial prototypes of stoves based mostly on existing camping stove designs to show that indeed customers will purchase ethanol and use it as a mainstream cooking solution if it is available in the neighborhood. That was the first part. So really showing the consumer appetite at our target price points. The second part was then to start working on the actual physical hardware prototypes. And the units were, as you can imagine, were very basic, very low levels of automation, not really designed for durability. But they proved the point that we could achieve the target economics, right? That was the key thing. That because our whole business model is based around achieving huge efficiency in the distribution of fuel and a high level of penetration or proximity to end customers. And so if we could use basic prototypes to demonstrate that we can make fuel available inside small shops, close to people's households, because we're able to use existing fuels infrastructure, we can make the price of the ethanol competitive with charcoal and kerosene. Those were the key points that we needed to prove. So you notice that a lot of what we were doing in our early iterations was not so much around demonstrating the technology itself or how we would develop these products, but more about the value of these products, right? That if this hardware were available at scale, the economics around it would work. And that was how we were able to mobilize the initial support. A vision and some demonstration of the potential economics of the solution were what we needed to then position ourselves to mobilize enough capital and give ourselves enough time to then work on, much better quality physical prototypes that we could then take to market. And in fact, we back in 2017, we did a beta launch. So we targeted a dozen neighborhoods in Nairobi. We made 1,000 prototype cookers. And we launched that very quietly in these selected neighborhoods. And not a surprise to us, but a surprise to many people, these cookers quickly snapped up by customers and they began using. At that point, we were just supplying the fuel ourselves. We didn't have a fuel company as a partner, but we used this demonstration to get over the final stages of mobilizing much more capital to set up our large-scale stoves factory, to get a fuel company on board as a partner, to really push with the government of Kenya to overcome all the licensing and other requirements we had. All of that was only possible in the end by demonstrating the whole system operating. And so, in short, it's a bit of an iterative process. I think it has to start with really creating comfort around the vision and around the demand that exists in the marketplace, and then using that to mobilize the capital to then improve the technology to be at the point where you have enough capital to then implement at scale. And really, over the last year, we have been very focused on finally achieving large-scale hardware production at the target price points. But it's been about 5 years of work or so before that to get ourselves in that position.
Wow, that's hugely exciting just to share that with us. And also, it's a huge lift. I mean, it's a huge endeavor that you're taking on. So it's really, really, really good to talk to you. I mean, as well, at this pivotal time as well, you're preparing for a much bigger scale. I've got to ask though, I mean, those early days when you were sharing the vision, you're proving out the consumer demand, is that funded from your own pockets? You were eating ramen noodles, or what was it? How did you get that initial capital just to do a basic consumer demand pilot?
Sure. So the very first stages, back in the 2014 timeframe or so for us, we funded ourselves. So it was extremely scrappy, we moved out to this region. We picked it from many other parts of the world for the bunch of reasons we talked about. We did some basic surveys and other things. And so that was very, very lean, but enough work to basically identify if this was the right market opportunity for us and then to start figuring out, exactly what the solution might look like. So that was quite lean. And then I think, and it was enough to show commitment, right? I think, which is very important. We quit our other ongoing activities for the co-founding team, and we really decided this is what we were going to do. And I think that's an important signal to send to potential partners. There are folks that sort of are interested in launching something, but oftentimes aren't fully into it and have other commitments. And we were fortunate that we were able to sort of break away from other commitments and decide this is what we want to do. Off the back of that, we started applying for grants. So the Global Alliance for Clean Cooking, as it was known then, was an early partner. They gave us a small grant from their innovation fund, and I hope they're happy with the results of that. But that was very early on. And that was basically based around the vision that we had and some early demonstration of the potential traction for a solution like this. And that was enough to basically help us establish here, start building the team, and then positioning ourselves to go out and look for other financiers. And over the course of the last 4 or 5 years, Coconut has been able to really connect with investors from around the world, family offices, foundations, other people who are interested in commercial solutions to address climate change, dirty cooking, and so forth. And so over the last few years, we've been able to bring in small amounts of capital, build a relationship, and as we hit our milestones, go back and really bring in the additional capital we've needed to be able to execute a launch at this scale and to build the team that we have today. Today, we have over 500 people now across our locations in Kenya and India. And you can imagine for a company like this where, you know, it's been 5 years of investment in technology development and manufacturing with essentially no revenue, right? And the revenue starts to flow once the network goes live, which can only really happen at scale. And so that's, I think, extremely unique in this market for a pure technology company that is essentially zero revenue until launch to get the backing. And that's fundamentally, you know, due to us in the early days, you know, trying to create that vision and work towards it, and then being able to mobilize support bit by bit over time through the years.
Wow. Okay. I mean, it's just incredible. We've just as well just touched on the hardware side of things, and there's so much more we could go into. But Sagan, this is just, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your knowledge, and for other social entrepreneurs out there, I want to thank you. And everyone, head over to coconetworks.com. That's where their website is. You can find out more there. It's kokonetworks.com. And we'll obviously link all of the things we talked about in this interview on the show notes. Sagan, thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you very much, Andy. Pleasure.
And that was Sagan Saxena, co-founder of Coca Networks. Thank you, Sagan, for coming on and, again, just sharing some immensely valuable lessons and talking about your journey to bring such a, you know, ambitious, incredible business model to market in Kenya. I wish you all the luck for global domination in the energy sector. And I want to thank you all for listening. I hope this was helpful. I'd love to hear your feedback. Make sure you send me an email with any tips at andy@findingimpact.com. And make sure you head over to findingimpact.com to sign up to our fortnightly newsletter, bringing you the latest podcasts and a few links to some choice articles. Okay, that's it for me. Have a great week.
Findingimpact.com. Helping you scale your social business.